You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CivCast. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of CivCast. My name is Kyle, and I'm joined by Dan, my co-host. Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
Doing all right, Kyle. It snowed again this week, so I'm trying to dig myself out of this white hell. I mean, it never snows here, and we've had like weeks of really bad snow, so it's been some kind of winter for us.
It sounds like it. We might get some rain here in LA, so that's something, right?
That's weather.
That's weather. That's a type of weather.
Weather.
I mean, it's some pattern of weather. So that's what we got to show for it. Actually, it's this weirdly overcast day. And I have to say, I woke up not really early. I got up around like 8 a.m. today. And weirdly, LA is dead quiet. Now, today's the Super Bowl and stuff, but that doesn't seem like a reason for the city to be quiet. But I took the dog out for his morning walk. And I mean, it was like silent. There were barely any cars. I don't know what's up. Did everyone run away from the city and I'm still here? Maybe I'm the last survivor, Dan.
It's possible. This could be like one of your zombie apocalypse scenarios, but I can tell. Well, actually, you know what? I look outside my window right now and I don't see anyone either. All I see is snow. So it's possible we're the only two people left alive. Well, actually three, because my wife is alive downstairs as far as
I
know.
Thank goodness.
So it could just be the three of us, Kyle. Who knows?
Well, so we should change the name to this. It's no longer CivCast. We are now the national, what is left of the National Broadcasting Network.
Yep.
And it's more than national because we're two different countries. So we're the North American Broadcasting Network, and we're here to give you all your zombie news.
Yeah, and after we're done this podcast, what you'll hear is one of those loud emergency tones. One of those beep. That's what they're going to hear.
Perfect.
For hours.
I love it.
Make sure you keep tuned in, folks.
So if it's a zombie apocalypse, I'm guessing that means I have all the time in the world to play Civilization, which is good. I mean, I'm going to take advantage as long as these servers are up, because this past week, Dan, I started a game playing Gorgo of Greece, which is not a very common one for me. But I was looking for a little bit of, you know, of a change up. I'm trying to get out there and explore with some new civs on occasion. And Greece seemed like a good one. Gorgo, she's got that cool perk where you kill a unit and you get 50% of its, I think, combat strength as culture points. So that's kind of cool. And the hoplites and all that fun jazz. So I was just having a good time. Anything new on your radar?
Nothing really new on my radar. I mean, I talked about the Russia game that I had started last week, and I didn't get a lot of time to play this week, unfortunately, because it was a busy week at work, but I'm going to have more time this week, and I really do want to grind out one of these. I haven't played through a full game in about a month or so, which kind of makes me a pretty crappy co-host here, but I mean, I just, work over Christmas was rough, but irrespective of that, I am hoping to get like a completed game done over the course of the next week. And I'm actually having a lot of fun with this game with Russia too. I do think that there's a bit of, what's the word I'm looking for here? A bit of, I don't want to say malaise, or a bit of like feeling like it's a bit recycled at this point, if only because I feel like I've played a lot of the game and I feel like I've seen a lot of, not the same civs, but a lot of like the same kind of situations and the same scenarios. And I find myself adapting to these situations in the same way. And so I think that what you and I are going to talk about a little later in the show, with some new victory types and some government nuances and stuff like that, might be a little bit of a way to spice it up, to spice things up.
I think that's a great idea. And you actually, in saying that, somehow jogged my memory that I wanted to tell people. I was poking around in some of the settings for the game yesterday or the day before. And I remember our talk about the Vikings DLC pack and how it wasn't really... It alone did not add the wonders and the new new city states into the game. I wanted to follow up and say that in the settings, because you can choose the additional content that you've got turned on, that Viking DLC pack in the additional content area does claim to add those extra city states into the game and the natural wonders. So just wanted to make maybe a correction. I mean, I didn't actually turn it. It would be kind of hard to play test that. You'd have to roll a couple different games and, you know, explore the world to make sure that turning that content on or off truly affected it. But just to add that, you know, if you are looking into that Viking DLC pack, I guess it is responsible for adding those in. So if you don't buy it, I guess you don't get the new city states.
Yeah, I think that we weren't sure about that. I know that I haven't seen any of those new city states, nor have I seen any of the three new wonders in game yet. Mm. So I wasn't sure if, again, that's just something that's kind of a luck of the draw thing. But yeah, if you're telling me that, you know, you do need the Vikings DLC in order to make that happen, well, then I guess I know what I'm spending $5 on today.
Well, and there you go. And you can just, what we're talking about, you can use it to maybe spice your game up a little bit. Not that those are like the top list things, you know, new city states and new natural wonders aren't really the biggest changes. But yeah, I mean, it, per the wording in that menu, it would very much seem like they had it. It reads as if I uncheck this box, those new city states and new wonders will not appear in the game. So, you know, I mean, hey, if you're looking to spice it up this weekend or this upcoming week, whatever, it's probably a good idea. You know, we recommended definitely the Poland DLC. So if you want some new things, new experiences, go ahead, go get that Viking DLC for what it's got.
Yeah. I mean, that would be a good plan.
Yeah. And I also kind of read the Polish pack actually looks like it added a multiplayer scenario where you are on the same team to defend Poland's pride and glory or something like that. I'll come back with more information on that next week. I might actually try that game type. But, you know, like I said, poking around in that additional content area, it looked like you might get a good scenario out of it. Something interesting where you're on a team against maybe the AI attacking you and trying to destroy Poland's legacy. Not sure. So
that would be nice for the multiplayer aspect. So I do know the multiplayer is something that people really want fleshed out. I remember when the game was coming down the pipe there with about a month or two to go, there was a lot of hype about, you know, the way all the changes they've made and kind of the fact that they've expedited a lot of the downtime and stuff in the game. And there was even some people who were talking about the possibility of Civ 6 being an esport, which just doesn't really seem like that would be theoretically possible. But people were really jacked up about the multiplayer coming into release. And I do know that the multiplayer itself has kind of fallen flat. I personally have played, I think, three different multiplayer games with friends. And I've had fun. I've had no problem with it. But I do feel like there's still a lot there, including scenarios, like you're saying, that could make it fuller and better.
Yeah, I think there's always room for improvement here. And that's actually, like you said, we're going to spend some time talking about that later in the episode, just some fun ideas, some things that I caught from Reddit that I thought were cool. So let's get into that in just a minute. But first, Dan, do you want to remind everyone our changes with the CivCast Challenge? Because it is now a month-long session. So if you want to give people a quick recap of how to play and all that info.
Sure. The CivCast Challenge, we have changed things up here, folks. We are moving it to a monthly challenge because I think 2 weeks was a bit of a time crunch for everyone involved, including, I know, myself and Kyle. I mean, we want to participate in it, but we don't always have the ability to set aside as much time as we would like to, you know, because we're trying different things in the game. We like experimenting with different things, so we have new things to come back to you guys with. And I was just finding that I wasn't able to engage every challenge. So feedback and everything taken into account, we've moved it to a month-long session. Your challenge for this month is almost kind of like your own little scenario. It's something that we put together where we're really emphasizing kind of the early game civs with a domination focus. So you will be playing the Aztecs, who have been opened up to everyone as of recently. The map you're playing is Pangaea, which is a map that facilitates a lot of early game conflict. You're going for a domination victory type. You are playing on a 6-player map size, which is the small map. Your difficulty is Emperor, your speed and resources and star bias and all that are standard. But the one kind of additional caveat that we've included is we've told you, instructed you what the five other civs in the game are to be. And those civs are Scythia, Sumeria, Egypt, Rome, and Greece as Gorgo, because all things considered, those five, along with the Aztecs, are the civs that are probably more focused towards early game military and early game battles. So it kind of made sense to us to, in order to facilitate kind of this scenario that we're putting together here, that you play the six most battle hungry bloodthirsty civs from early in the game. So
yeah, that they are. You know, these guys are really ones to pack a wall up when they hit you because of their unique units, like Scythia's ability with those horse archers, the duplicate ones. That's something nasty. So KyleDempsterStudios.com has all the information you'll need for this in terms of finding your map type and all that info that Dan just nicely presented for you, but you can see it in a text form there. I admit, I've been kind of bad about putting this into our Steam group, but I did want to remind people we have a Steam group going on. If you follow us on Twitter, I try to post that link to the Steam group at least once a week. I think we're above like 25 people in it right now, which is pretty good, just seeing that I haven't been really hands-on with it that much. I'm not a huge Steam group guy myself, but I really want to adopt that a bit more when I have more time on my hands, because what a great way to meet other people playing the game and a really easy way to kind of coordinate doing a multiplayer game. So after I get this big move out of my way and get settled into the new apartment, I'm really looking to dive deeper into that. And I've promised for the past couple months that we're going to do a multiplayer game. And I admit I've failed to deliver on that, but we've all been moving in totally different directions and everything we're doing. So it's been a little bit hard to get that together, but we should see if we can get Valter in and get everyone together, all the friends of the network, and try and do some multiplayer soonish.
Yeah, and if you're out there and you want to join up in a multiplayer with us, tweet at us or send us a message in Steam. I know that a lot of you have added Kyle and I to Steam. Just give us a shout out, send us an email, whatever. Tell us that you want to take part and really kind of light the fire under our butts here. Get us to really start this this multiplayer thing, and
yeah,
we will.
There's nothing wrong with harassing me via Twitter about getting on a thing I said I was going to do in one of the previous shows. Nothing wrong with that. So, you know, I don't know. I'm making it through, but I'm making it through the move, Dan. This thing's actually coming together, and I'm moving in, I guess, 10 days. Is 10 days I get my moving truck, start loading it up, so a little bit after that, we should be all set. And I did want to kind of bring this up to note that it should not affect any of the podcasts coming up here. Today is February 5th. So February 12th, I'm totally good to record. The 19th is possibly TBD. If there's some sort of delay in me being able to pick up the new modem and all that for the new apartment or whatever, or if I'm for some reason really far behind in unpacking and setting up my podcasting thing, there's a chance we may not record on Sunday, February 19th. But if that's the case, if we don't record that date, you know we'll be back the 26th to get back into the groove of things here. So just wanted to give everyone a friendly little update of how things are going. And then, so we've got some great feedback for later in the show. I also want to dive into that. So if anyone wants to send feedback to the show, just as a reminder, we've got that nice little link on the page, KyleDempsterStudios.com/Civcast is where you can send in your thoughts. And also CivcastPodcast@gmail.com will be the place you can send in any thoughts you have for the show. That's also where you can do that harassing to make me keep my promises. But to stick with what we told you at the beginning of the show, let's dive into some concepts that we were thinking up about how to kind of implement change in the future of the game, what we want to see and how that might come about. And I want to lead off on this, Dan, by kind of sharing this idea for spheres of influence. I saw this very interesting Reddit post. Let's see, I'm going to open it right now. But when did this actually get posted? It was only 6 hours ago, so it's very, very recent, and it's called Pins Meet Aztec Hiking Trail. So I thought this was a really cool one, and I know I have this set to come out on our Twitter page here shortly, but to summarize this picture, we've got two different cities here, two different Aztec cities, and in the middle, there is this very large mountain range, but what's cool is it has a one-tile passage that goes through it, and this is a long one. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, about eight to nine tiles worth of this zigzagging trail that goes through this cool mountain range and links these Aztec cities, hence the name hiking trail. But what some people later on in this post were talking about is there were asking if there's or if there should be an implementation of a way to claim an area so that you don't have AIs meddling with it. So, for example, if I just plop down my capital, I plop down another city next to it, and I have this clear progression of where I'm going to go next, no one should be settling that spot. But for some reason, a random settler comes along and throws it down. Or even in late game, you know, when you've got nice clustered cities and clearly an area is in your control, but then, you know, an enemy AI throws a city down there. Those are fighting words, but in the game, they're not. In the game, you know, the AI might settle right next to your capital and say, oh, I didn't know that you would mind me settling there. Really? Really? Has it happened to you,
yeah,
Dan?
Yeah. Oh, that's definitely happened to me. I mean, and then you kind of, because they seem to do it all the time. If you settle near them without fail, they will send you that message saying, you know, don't settle near me. And you're like, okay, my bad, sorry. But when they do it near you, I feel like, I almost feel, I guess, I don't know, guilty or whatever of messaging them. And they're like, oh, sorry, we won't do it again. And sure enough, they do it again, like, you know, 50 turns later or whatever.
Oh, yeah. I have a very memorable one of playing the Congo. I think it was Congo or that or Germany. And we were in probably mid-game. I think, you know, we were in the machinery era there. And they kept trying to settle this ridiculously small kind of peninsula thing that was happening. And it was like, why would you even put your city there, first of all? It doesn't make sense strategically. There wasn't enough resources and all that. But it was like clearly the leftover of where my city could not expand to. And I was like, really? Yeah. You're going to take that? So to kind of summarize this, keep it streamlined. There's an interesting idea here of potentially making these kind of spheres of influence or tiles that you could lay claim to without actually settling yet. You know, you'd kind of be announcing to the world that it is your intention to take that territory because it is in your area. It's your sphere. You want it. It should be yours. So don't settle here. If you do settle here, so I'm not saying there's a mechanic barring them from, but if they do settle there, it should have a much higher penalty of, hey, you just settled in my backyard. Get out. Like, this is war. You know, we're going to take that city if you choose to settle in my sphere of influence. Dan, do you think you'd mentioned maybe this should come at a later era? Do you have any thoughts on this concept?
I do. I think that it's, if you look at spheres of influence as kind of a modern construct, I think that you could really do something there. I think that, I mean, in a modern sense, spheres of influence are often used when describing things like during the Cold War, NATO versus the Warsaw Pact, or currently, if you look at the spheres of influence of like ethnographic distribution, like the West, and then the Chinese sphere of influence, the Eastern European sphere of influence, things like that, you know, the Middle Eastern Islamic sphere of influence. I think that it's not something that was part of the historical kind of structure of how governments functioned really back in the day so much because diplomacy wasn't an evolved thing. Mm-hmm. So I think if you're going to have the whole sphere of influence idea as part of an evolved and far more nuanced and complex diplomatic system, I think it would really work. I think that it could have everything to do with not just where you settle, but who you make your alliances with, you know, where those alliances are being made. I think of like, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, on the sphere of influence controversy that came up with the Russians, the Soviets, I should be historically appropriate, making allies with a country that was so close to the United States. Spheres of influence can absolutely go, certainly in the early game, if you want them to be kind of something that builds up. In the early game, they could have to do with where you directly settle or where you send your military. But in the later game, it could have to do with, you know, who you make alliances with or who you are trading with and how that impacts a sphere of influence, which could be something that it could, if they really wanted to evolve it, you could have like, you know, a specifically colored map that shows, you know, here's your sphere of influence in purple. And oh, here's the sphere of influence that's dominated by, you know, the Congo in yellow. You know how they have those different map lenses and
totally.
Stuff like that. You could totally evolve something like that as part of a grown and evolved diplomatic system. And I think, Kyle, it would be really cool. It would be really nuanced. I think it would probably be really hard for them to develop, but hell, they've developed more complex things mm-hmm. over time. And I think Firaxis is up for a challenge. So, you know, long answer to your question, yes, I think there's something they really could do here that would be quite fantastic and would kind of echo what Paradox has been doing a little bit with Europa Universalis, with the whole sphere of influence thing. and it could really add some depth to the game.
I love that you not only like are in agreement when it comes to the colonial, you know, that sort of settling phase, but I do like how you're, you know, suggesting taking this and advancing it, which, I mean, the civic system as it stands in this game is a fantastic way to do exactly what you said. I mean,
yeah.
It wouldn't be hard in the sense that, okay, you know, I just need to kind of go for that civic and then that's going to change it over. That's the point where it's no longer just about settling an area. Now it's about my alliances and other things, because alliances are unlocked through the civics tree anyway. You know, you can't just declare an alliance on day one of the game. You know, it's something you have to wait till much later on. So I love that idea of development in that way. I think this would be, like you said, I think it's a challenge, but one that could easily be undertaken. And I think you would really get a lot for it. You know, thinking of all, and it might be hard to do in terms of, I think there'd be a lot of reworking of the AI and how they react to things. And I think every Civ 6 player can pretty much come together and say, yeah, the AI is not really where we want it to be at the moment. So I know that would be a challenge there logistically. But still, boy, that would make for some interesting wars. I think it would make your wars all the more substantial in a way. It's like, hey, I laid claim to this territory because there's a reason I want it. It wouldn't just feel so random. You know, if they move a settler into an area and put it down right now, it's like, well, I didn't have any claims to it other than in my head. You know, if you're playing multiplayer, maybe you're chatting with your friend over Discord and saying, oh, please don't settle here. I'm going for that. If you guys are kind of playing a pseudo team game. But when it comes to the AI, there's no sort of way to tame their wanting to move there. So a system like this could easily add that extra substance to it. It can make you feel like your decisions are a bit more impactful. And so kind of going from this idea, Dan, before the show, we were talking about maybe some other evolved diplomacies, and we've kind of touched on that a bit. And in the past, we've definitely talked about diplomacy potentially getting districts in the future. But I want to kind of talk about this concept because it's kind of fun. Right now, when you're switching government types in the game, you know, whether you're going communism or you've been a monarchy or a classical republic or oligarchy, whatever you were, those concepts don't ring so true to me. Meaning, I expect more. If I'm going to change my government from a monarchy to a communist government, there's no real upheaval in this game. It doesn't really affect my style of playing. Basically, what it does is it lets me assign different policy cards. I get some different bonuses, and then I go on with my day. Dan, we were kind of saying that maybe there should be a little bit more impact. Do you have thoughts of, like, you know, how you'd like to see that bleed through? Should going from a monarchy to a communist government radically change your gameplay, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, this is such... people who've been listening to the show, this is such a complex discussion. I could spend hours talking about this, Kyle. Legit, I could, because I think there's so much they could do with this game to make the diplomacy more in-depth and make it more immersive. I mean, it starts with making sure that you bring back a diplomatic victory. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it starts with evolving the way that you interact with government in the game to begin with. You need diplomacy districts, and diplomacy districts should be specific to your type of government. I mean, if you're going with a communist government, I guess, say, not that a communist government is a thing. That's not a thing. That's mm-hmm. an ideology. But if you're going with that, maybe your unique building that you get in your diplomacy district is different. But irrespective of that, just looking at the way that government fundamentally functions in this game, if you look at the government tree, it starts off coming out of chiefdom. You have the option of going to autocracy, classical republic, and oligarchy, right?
Yep.
Which are all kind of, fundamental political kind of leans. Now, to be clear, autocracy isn't a type of government, right? It's an ideology, right? Mm-hmm. A classical republic is a form of government. An oligarchy is sort of a form of government, but it's more a way that a government structures and functions than a type of government. But when you get later on in the game, what really, really bothers me is your second wave of government. They give you the option of monarchy, theocracy, and merchant republic. Now, mm-hmm. a monarchy is obviously a form of government,
yep.
and a theocracy is kind of a take on monarchy with the religious lean. A merchant republic is not a form of government. I mean, really, the only merchant republic, there have been merchant republics per se in history, I guess you could say, like yeah. merchant republic city-states like Venice, or maybe the Netherlands under William of Orange. But, mm-hmm. you know, if you went in and asked them what type of government they would never say merchant republic. And then later on, the Third Age is when it really bothers me, because you have a form of government in democracy, but then you have two ideologies in communism and fascism. Those are not forms of government, right? Those are ideologies. So to me, I think if Civ wants to fundamentally change the way they're approaching government, they should approach ideology and type of government in a different way. So if you're approaching type of government, people should be allowed to have you know, your basic kinds of governments, which are democracy, monarchy, dictatorship, republic, maybe aristocracy if you want to go complex, mm-hmm. but nothing beyond that, because those are the fundamental forms of government. And then what you can do is you can tack ideology onto that form of government. Am I making sense here, Kyle?
You are. And if I can chime in here briefly, yeah. I like what you're saying. You jogged my memory of a debate that has been had before, not on this show actually, but I think in more of Reddit threads and such. I like the idea of what you're saying, that you could make a dictatorship, because I saw someone ask for this before, maybe even a mod thread. And mm-hmm. what the responses to this were, the game's already a dictatorship, no matter how you look at it, because it's only one person, right, at the controls yeah. of this game.
Yeah.
But this kind of makes me wonder, and I hope I'm not, you know, shoehorning this in here too much, but maybe this relates to your exact idea where, depending on what structure you go with, maybe your government gives you a little bit more pushback.
Yes.
Like, I would not mind someone challenging my decisions for certain things in the game. That does not mean, where did Kyle move his builder or worker or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. Don't, you know, I hope my government doesn't yell at me for that or for putting a farm somewhere. But if I'm going to make a more sweeping change to things, I would not mind pushback. And also, for reference, we're going to talk about relating things to Civ 5 and later in the show too, but
yeah.
In Civilization V, the way it worked, those were labeled as ideologies. You know, you pick democracy, communism, or fascism. So, but I think Civ 4, and my memory for that game is so bad, I think it was Civ 4 or earlier, they actually had a very extensive type of government system. We should maybe look into that. I would love to have a strict episode where we went into further detail than this, but hopefully I can get this back around to your idea so you can continue on. But you're making total sense. It would make sense to have a separate ideology, or ideology be a separate field versus government structure. I liked where you're going with that.
Well, I think that, yeah, because what you could do, like, say, you shouldn't just be able to go and take a classical republic and then, you know, go and all of a sudden morph that into theocracy, like it's this smooth thing, and then all of a sudden morph it into communism, to your point that you were making earlier, with it just being like this completely smooth kind of, you know, thing that you're doing on rails or whatever, because mm-hmm. that's not how it functions in real life. How cool would it be if, you know, when you go and you approach, say, monarchy, there's like variants of monarchy. Like, initially when you pick monarchy, you can have an absolutist monarchy, mm-hmm. or you could have more of kind of a constitutional monarchy, a la what the British did after the Glorious Revolution in 1688. Or if you decide to go with kind of your authoritarian type of government, we can call it post-monarchy, we could call it whatever, you could call it a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. Well, you can decide what kind of dictatorship that forms. You could have it based on ideology be a dictatorship that is, you know, fascist in structure, communist in structure, or even go deeper and, you know, you can have theocracy as part of an authoritarian government structure. You know, if you have democracy, what kind of democracy do you want? Attach that to more of an ideological structure. It shouldn't just be kind of this ad hoc thing where you just, oh, you're going to go through and click government types as time goes along, and oh, I get legacy bonuses, but who pays attention to that?
Right.
It should be a more complex system. And to your point, it should be something that has a level of pushback. If I've been running a classical republic and I morph that into a monarchy, and then all of a sudden, you know, I get my third wave government type decision, and I say, nope, screw it, I'm going communism. Well, you know, I should have, you know, production penalties for that.
Yeah.
I should have that. I should have, you know, dissatisfaction among the populace. I should lose amenities. I should have other governments in my sphere of influence, to build on your sphere of influence idea earlier, getting concerned or getting worried. I should have some kind of socio-political backlash for the decisions I make in the game surrounding my government type, because government and the way that you structure your country's government and the way that your country is run is really the foundation of the modern state. And in this game, it does not feel like that, right? It doesn't. It feels like a tacked on thing. When you choose your government, it's like, whatever, what because, you know, I need more soldiers right now or whatever, right?
Right.
And it needs to be more of a complex system. You can tell I'm getting really stoked about this. This is something I've been thinking about, man.
2 points for you, Dan, here. I'm thinking, one, in a mod in Civ 5, there was a situation where it overhauled the point system because, you know, the government in Civ 5 was all about plugging in points. It wasn't a civics tree. One of the overhaul mods was a very extensive one. It changed every point system. But what it did was it added a pro and a con to choosing each different point or each peg you're taking. So if I had one that increased food production, it might also, you know, make people less happy or something like that, which in a way, you know, is kind of like real life. You know, no government decision can be made and everyone will be happy. You know, like if you're watching the show Parks and Recreation or anything like that in the past, you know, in a jokey way, you see that any decision a government makes has sometimes just ridiculous pushback from the people, you know, we don't want that park for whatever reason. But that's fair. You know, people are not clones and, you know, we all have different opinions on things. So it makes sense you get pushback. However, there was something odd feeling for me as the player. I felt weird choosing a pro that I knew would give me a con. Now, maybe that's because I knew that there was a complexity to it that it was introducing that I didn't care to give my full brain power to, you know, maybe that might have been the simple turnoff. And then I bring that question in and say, does that affect us in Civ 6? Would implementing a system where you do get pushback, would that be so negative that the player would not do it? I will say in Civ 5, you could change your ideology. However, when you went to go and change it, so if I wanted to go from a communism to a fascism sort of ideology, you would get, there was kind of that rebellion mechanic or something. Your people would get angry at you for changing it. Now, here's the thing. I don't remember that mechanic because I never changed because I knew that there was a downside to it. Sometimes, you know, in video games, decisions can be so subconscious almost. Like in Civ 6, I won't unlock policies by spending money. You know, you get the free policy unlock every time you research a civic. That simple monetary value, which is actually very cheap, the cost there is enough to turn me away from it. Not even like on such a conscious level, but I'm like, oh, that's an ouchie. I'm not going to do it. Like, so I'm wondering, though it makes absolute sense and would make it for us very passionate Civ players, though I like this idea of a pro and a con and some uprising, I'm just throwing it out there, devil's advocate. I wonder if that's like a bad thing in like a focus group sort of way. Wonder if that turns people off.
It's possible, but I mean, the way that you have to approach that is not to remove complexity. It's to add, you know, layers to the onion, so to speak. It's to add further complexity. So you talked earlier about the idea of a sphere of influence. Well, what about this? What if your sphere of influence, say that you are in the sphere of influence of Germany, and then Germany approaches you and says, you know, via the diplomatic system, and says to you, we would like you to change your ideology to communism, say. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, we will give you these bonuses. You will get this provided for you. Oh. Yes, you will have difficulties in your state. You might have these kind of negative things that Firaxis programs in, like negative production. Well, actually, that would probably increase production, but negative amenities or whatever else. But because it is the dominant government type in your sphere of influence, you will also get maybe gold bonuses, or you will get troops provided to you from the dominant state that has approached you and requested this, or something like that. Have that tied into your fantastic earlier idea about spheres of influence. Because, I mean, if you think about the way that that functioned in the real world, specifically, I look back at the Cold War, mm-hmm. you know, you had the West and the East leaning on other countries telling them, you know, adopt our ideology, adopt our form of government, and we will provide you with this. We will give you this, you know. That could be something that would be implemented. And I don't think that would be terribly complex into an evolved diplomacy in the game. What do you think about that?
I think this is all very possible. And this is actually, I think this whole conversation is awesome. And I am in love with it because it's so, this isn't us being bummers on Foreign Access. This is saying you have awesome opportunity to leverage this, because I think we're all in agreement that we're likely going to get a very good diplomatic update and expansion pack at some point. You know, it's bound to happen. It happened with Civ 5 with Brave New World
expanded
a lot of that. So I think it's coming. Firaxis even said, you know, they just need to realize how we are playing through the game at the moment, then to make a very analytical decision at the end after they see it. And I think this is great room for growth. I think that the that idea of a sphere of influence area is a great way to balance and kind of bolster the ideas that we're having here. I think that makes total sense, that if you are within someone's sphere of influence and you decide to take on their ideology as well, it would make sense that you could share those strong bonuses. I think maybe the one thing that would have to happen, and this would be give player value, is unlike the mod I'm referencing from Civ 5, which I think was pretty much a straight trade-off, it's like, oh, you get plus 3% towards this thing, say it's production or whatever. And I think it was also you get negative 3% whatever to this. So it was like a flat trade. But if in this case, if your bonus is like double the bad that you get as a negative, then that pays off. I guess that would let you... What that would do is it would, you know, you'd be doubling down on something that you're good at or something that you want, and you'd be kind of taking away of something, you know, that's a little bit less important to you. As long as it feels like growth, I think, to the player, then it's worth it. I think that mod wasn't growth. It was a fair trade, and that, to me, was where it kind of sat funny. I think this is a fantastic idea. I want this, Dan. How can we get this in the game right now?
Well, I don't know about right now, but hey, if Firaxis, if you're listening, you have the ability. I know that you're not trying to make a grand strategy game. I know that you're not trying to make a super complex to the point where the nuances can turn some casual gamers off type thing. But I don't think in, we'll call it maybe an intermediate level diplomatic system with some of these nuances on a higher level. I mean, I'm not saying to you, you know, oh, you should have like kleptocracy as an option or nepotocracy or whatever. I'm not saying go that deep.
I don't know what those are.
those are different forms of like aristocratic government, where kleptocracy is where you're ruled basically as a mafia state, and nepotocracy is where you're basically ruled through nepotism.
Yeah.
But anyway, don't get that in depth on it. You don't need to get that in depth. But just on a fundamental level, take Kyle's idea about spheres of influence, build that into an evolved diplomatic system. Then take what I was talking about separating government and ideology. Implement the two together, tie them together in a bow, call it a new diplomatic system, and, you know, at the end of it, send us a royalties check.
Yeah, hey, I like that one. And by the way, if you want, you can send it to us direct, or you can even just head over to our Patreon and put that in there for access, whatever you'd like. I'm thinking about this, and I'm really loving this system more and more and more, and I think it would be so easy for them to implement it, kind of given the current state of the game. And I'm in total agreement with you. I'm not looking to make Civ 6 into some grand strategy game that it is not. I'm choosing this game intentionally because I don't really... I love a good strategy game, but I am not a huge Europa, Universalis fan and like Hearts of Iron and stuff. I haven't actually played Hearts of Iron, but from what I've seen of it, it might be pushing my boundary, because I do like a good like top-down RTS, so I like action and movement So I guess Civ 6 is my balance between, you know, maybe it's my happy medium between just an RTS and a grand strategy game. So I want it to stay in that area. I don't want it to be something that it's not. I just think that what we're coming up with here, these are really good and very, I would think that they'd be pretty easy ideas to put into the game to work in. And maybe they're not super, super easy, but again, we're saying, you know, it could be done through an expansion pack. But I think that the way that they're already currently handling things allows this. It facilitates this as an easier change. We're kind of just, you know, elaborating on things that already exist. You know, with the addition of the lenses system, you know, you toss that in there with your spheres of influence idea that exists. You know, if we're talking about laying down the sphere, that could either be done something similar to how like a worker builds a fort. If you want to make it a physical, you know, it has to be plopped down sort of system, or it could be done through like kind of a map pin system that's on a global level, not just a personal, you know, your own UI thing. I don't know, but these things could very easily be worked in. And I think you could also take advantage of that amazing district system that came about. And we've talked about this before, but it would be cool to see some sort of district that pops up as a diplomatic district. And maybe you could even work in the embassies that you can build in other people's cities right now. You know, once you're good enough friends, maybe that embassy helps you build that sphere of influence. Maybe it gives your sphere of influence a larger radius. I don't know. You know, they're already there though, the building blocks.
Absolutely. Implement city states into it too, where you
totally
can, if you want to extend your sphere of influence into someone else's, well, you give a city state money, you give a city state troops, and then you tell it, you know, go fight these guys. And then that's you kind of interfering in their sphere. And it would just add such a wonderfully nuanced and necessary level of diplomacy to the game that I know that, and I know that Firaxis has a lot of really smart people who make these games. And I know to your point, Kyle, when you talk about grand strategy as being a bit of a turnoff, it's a completely different kind of game. And I understand that grand strategy and the idea of spending, you know, 50 minutes every turn, making sure that everything's okay in your whatever country civilization is not what some people want. But I think there is a sweet spot there where you can, in an accessible and user-friendly way, introduce these kind of more complex aspects to a diplomatic system where people who love more strategy and more complexity to it will adore it. And people who are a bit more hands-off and maybe focus more on the military aspect or always go for a culture victory would still see advantage in doing it, right?
Yeah. I think this is kind of just about making, again, it's been my mantra since day one of the podcast, which is make decisions or make concepts of the game that make it feel valuable to the player. Mm-hmm. I think the worst thing you can do, not the worst, because I am not bashing grand strategy games at all. That is a thing that I should even start playing more of, because if I gave it the time, I would surely like it. But again, sticking with this simple concept, I feel like what you do not want to do is make it strictly a numbers game. Civ 6 has a good way of marrying physical things moving around on the board with these numbers that are attached. And I think the worst thing you can do is just slap a coat of paint on something in a game like this and say that it's something else. I don't even know how to describe this so much. They kind of, some of the things in Civ in the past even, and Civ 6, they kind of feel, I don't want to say, like, I'm almost thinking like ghostly. It's like, you can kind of see this visage of it, but it's not really physical or tangible. So I guess that's the way that, like we were saying, you know, if you slap on communism, nothing really changes in your country. There's no difference to how it functions versus going over to fascism. And I don't mean to beat this horse until it's dead, but
past that point.
But you know, you kind of do want to feel something from it. Now, Dan, we had this great conversation. We ran a little bit late here. You know, we're actually going on and on into the show. And we wanted to talk about this idea of an economic victory. So maybe we table that idea for next week's show, if that's okay with you. And just tell people And I think we could blend this into our question of the week. So Dan and I have this light concept for what an economic victory type could be for the game. So how about, listeners out there, you shoot us a tweet or an email with what you think an economic victory would look like, because there's definitely room for expansion when it comes to these victory types. You know, they're adding them, they're making them into different scenarios, all kinds of things like that. It's very likely that we see some more emerge in the future if they choose to go that route. So you tell us what it would take to win an economic victory. We've got ideas, but we want to hear yours. So civcastpodcast@gmail.com for those via email, or like I said, tweet them to us on Twitter. But quickly, and I don't know if we're going to be able to give this enough time, and if we have to put this on to next week, we will. But I wanted to share, we got some great listener feedback for Bernadette, who we actually, I incorporated some of this into the show. I'm going to read this really quickly. She said, I love the show, the podcast so far. I had to wait a few months before I got Civ 6 because I was upgrading my computer. I've been playing the franchise for 20 years and love it. Back when Civ 5 launched, I read reviews and decided to wait a bit to buy. I was still loving Civ 4 so much, I just decided to keep playing within it. I kept playing, and when Civ 6 was announced, I decided to go ahead and make the jump directly to 6, you know, not purchasing 5. I'm loving Civ 6 and everything, but I noticed that when I have a question about something, answers online typically and usually contain a response like, well, it happens just like in Civ 5. And then she shakes her head and says, well, you know, I didn't play Civ 5, so that reference point doesn't help. So if you find yourself saying this, can you please explain a bit more about the topic for people who went from earlier versions of Civ 4? And also, she noticed that people ask questions about certain elements and think, I misread that a bit. She said, I also noticed that people will ask questions about certain elements in the game, and I will think it's just going to happen like in Civ 4. But it's a big change. So what I want to kind of first, address this is I apologize. I very much forget Civ 4. I actually apparently played quite a bit of it with my friend, but I only have flashes of memory from it for some reason. I'm just going to attribute it to the 6 years of Civilization 5 I played nonstop. So maybe that just completely overwrote my Civ 4 memories. So if I'm ever saying, oh, it's just like Civ 5, it might actually just be me lacking the perspective and the scope to say anything about Civ 4. I try and reference it on occasion. The last thing she mentioned was the strangest concept for her coming into Civ 6 was the domination victory type, which is more like the conquest victory. And they got rid of the old domination. So if that confused you how I read that, I want to summarize something I found on the Civ Fanatics forum, which says a conquest victory requires you to have no rivals. This was achieved either by conquering them, vassalizing them, or by combining those two methods. A domination victory was achieved when you get the most land area and population. It can also be achieved the same way you get a conquest. But basically, not to spend too much time on this or to dwell, but Dan, do you remember this sort of concept, a change between your domination and conquest types?
No, because like you, I got a little bit of Civ 4, but I think what she's saying here has some real merit, because the way they have domination victory right now is it's pure military domination, mm-hmm. right? Well, to our point of nuance and of complexity, you know, domination doesn't always have to be, oh, look, I have more soldiers. I destroyed all of your cities. I am, you know, God, king, huge man, big, strong man.
Yep.
What it could be is economic domination, diplomatic domination. And to her point, yeah, conquest is more of like a military thing, but domination as a victory type should be more than that. I mean, she mentions how domination victory is achieved when you get the most land area and population before. Well, that sounds to me more like domination than just having more military units, doesn't it? I mean, there's more nuance and complexity to the idea of a domination victory than just I rolled your city with my sack of horse archers.
I am in agreement. I think that there's a lot more to be done with it. And like I said, I think maybe we can table that portion of it too and take that on next week, because that's mm-hmm. kind of a perfect tie-in, right? If we're going to talk about mm-hmm. an economic victory, this is a great, great, great conversation, because I do think that just taking someone's capital is – It is a sensible win type. I agree with it. I think that should stay in the game. But I think that there should be more to, you know, more options than that, because it is kind of a very vanilla version. You know, there could definitely be little spins and takes on it that make it cooler. So let's come back to that next week. Again, reminder, question of the week, tell us what your economic victory type would entail. How do we win it? So send that over. We asked last week what wonder people would like to see added to the game. We only got one response. So if you want to add that into your thing next time, please do. But someone, you know what? I don't even have the name put in here. Oops. But someone on Twitter had sent in the Mackenzie River being an option. Dan, it looks like it was hashtag Canadian there. Can you lend any thoughts on this?
I think that's, I mean, that would be a world wonder and less of a wonder. I mean, the idea of being Canadian, kind of the idea of whether they can implement Canada in as a sieve in the game. And let's be honest, all my fellow Canadians listening to it, we would be a boring as hell sieve to have in the game. All right, let's be honest. Like, what would our civilization bonus be? Like, if at peace for all game get extra like plus six Tim Hortons, like what would be our bonus?
Hey, I like that one.
It's not such a bad one, right? Or I mean, we get a plus five hockey combat strength or
maybe
something like that.
You get to travel on America's roads faster to come down and shop or something. Is that?
Oh, I like that. And depending what government type the Americans adopt, we might see an influx of them into the Canadian civilization.
Yes. But, oh, that's great.
But no, I think it's a cool idea. I do like how they talk about Creative or Voyageurs being unique units for a Canadian civ. And Creative and Voyageurs are these old from our colonial days when we were being colonized by both the French and the English. Creative and Voyageurs were these men who would travel from Eastern Canada across the Western frontier, mainly as part of corporations in order to not to colonize, but really in order to just kind of establish trading posts with the First Nations people who are across like Manitoba and the frontier in that direction. So I think that's cool. And yeah, if you have a unique unit for Canada, I think that it can't really be a military unit. It would probably have to be something that was more facilitated economically. But I think that it would be interesting to have Canada as a civ, but I don't really know necessarily if people would have a lot of fun playing us as a civ, I guess, to this person's point.
I'm sure they'll get modded into the game, right?
They have been in the past.
So
yeah.
There
and
you
I think someone modded them into Civ 5 and Lester Pearson was the leader. And I think actually the Civ bonus was something to the effect of like, you know, if you're at peace, you get plus 50 percent representation in the World Congress or something like that, which seems appropriate.
Mega unit. You can send a Justin Bieber to other people's countries as a spy, and then you have to, I don't know, that just wrecks them. That's the one
kind of domination. Domination by terrible music.
You send that to their theater district?
Yeah, you can have the Nickelback emissary unit, the Celine Dion emissary unit. Great. That would be how we could infiltrate American culture.
That is perfect. Dan, you gave us some nice little history there. So do you want to roll us straight into your Civ of the Week in Dan's Historical Minute?
So I actually kind of separated Civ of the Week from Historical Minute this week. I wanted to talk really quickly, Kyle, about Greece. I know that you're playing Greece and Gorgo right now. But this kind of schism that exists between if you play Greece with Pericles or Greece with Gorgo. I think from looking at Greece, irrespective of which leader you go with, I think that they are a civ that is clearly geared towards a culture victory. I mean, the Acropolis is a unique, but what are your thoughts on the Acropolis, Kyle?
I have actually none. Is this bad that I've never really even gotten to totally use it for what it's worth, is how little I've played of Greece.
No, that's not bad at all. I mean, it gives you plus one great writer point, plus one great artist point, and plus one great musician point. So in that sense, it's excellent for the great person game. Mm-hmm. And then you also get a lot of adjacency bonuses. You get plus one culture from each adjacent wonder, plus one culture from each adjacent district, and plus two culture from being adjacent to the city center. So in the early game, it gives you the possibility to really ratchet up your culture score. And in that sense, it seems really great. I don't see your play style as being fundamentally altered if you pick Gorgo as opposed to Pericles. I know with Gorgo, her unique leader bonus, Thermopylae, is combat victories provide culture equal to 50% of the combat strength of the defeated unit. So that would lead you to believe that maybe she has more of a military lean, which mm-hmm. she does. But that is just kind of one route to the same end from Pericles, which is just you are still gearing towards a culture victory. You're just getting there by being a bit stronger, whereas with Pericles, it's more of a straightforward, you know, you get plus 5% culture for each city-state you're a suzerain of. It's not going to, you know, make you – going Gorgo as opposed to Pericles is not going to make you shift your victory-type focus away from culture, I don't think. So Greece seems to me like, and this whole experiment in having different leaders seems to me like something that could definitely be built on, obviously. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, I think if you're playing Greece, your focus should be on a culture victory. If you're playing Pericles, you really should just be throwing everything at that. And if you're playing Gorgo, you probably would just in the early game want to focus more on, you know, maybe some early game raids or something like that in order to facilitate culture. But that bonus really, I don't think would be super useful in the late game, Kyle.
Yeah. I need to get into the two of them and kind of figure both like what the differences are, you know, to determine what's strong one way or the other. I will, you know, chime in here really quickly and say, I forgot how powerful them getting a one wild card policy slot extra. That is a huge, huge, huge bonus from the, mm-hmm. you know, the start of the game, even more mm-hmm. so than Germany's plus you know, a military slot, because that's not necessarily helpful on turn one. But yeah, these guys are strong.
Yeah, early game beasts. Mm-hmm. The Plato's Republic civability is fantastic for sure.
And who do we have for a historical minute, Dan?
Well, I mean, look, we folks, in case you didn't notice, we ratcheted down talk this week because I think that last week we had implemented politics into the show, and that might not be something that we should be doing just for everyone's mental health, really.
Yes.
I know that everyone generally with shows like this, you kind of like to take a break from the world around you. But I did feel the need. One of the few leaders or civs that I haven't talked about in my historical minute is America and Teddy Roosevelt. And so I thought I would talk about Teddy Roosevelt specifically here, how he relates historically into the game. Now, Kyle, what is Teddy's unique leader bonus in this game? Do you know it off the top of your head?
Unique leader? I don't know his lead. Is his about getting... His is something about strength on the continent, I believe. Like, doesn't he get a combat bonus on his continent?
Yeah, he gets plus 5 combat strength on your home continent,
yay,
plus 1 appeal to all tiles in a city with a national park.
Ooh.
So the national park thing obviously stands out to me, and the whole national park system in the game, I think, is something that's still in its infancy. But we probably have a lot of American listeners here, and those who know their history know that Teddy Roosevelt was a guy who was all about conservation and was all about the environment. Kyle, you know all about
oh,
that,
yeah.
right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Teddy, he was a Republican, but he was a guy who was a prominent conservationist, and he put the issue of conservation of wilderness and wild areas of America high on his national agenda. He established the U.S. Forest Service. He signed into law the creation of 5 national parks. He signed the 1906 Antiquities Act, which proclaimed 18 U.S. national monuments. He established a ton of bird reserves, game reserves, national forests. So by the time Teddy left office, the area that he had placed under public natural protection was the equivalent of about 230 million acres, which is about 930,000 square kilometers. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is with national parks and with conservation being something that is in the news, and I know that those of you who were following the Badlands National Park Twitter account last week know exactly what I was talking about. I think it's important to remember that you can't tie ideology to conservation. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was a conservative, and he was a strict Republican and everything like that, but he was all about conservation. Conservation is something That's more about how you personally as a leader interact with the world around you. And a guy like Teddy was out there loving wilderness. The Rough Riders were all about being out in the great Western frontier and seeing everything that your beautiful and wonderful country has to offer in terms of natural beauty. And so, you know, at a time right now where we might be worried that conservation and the natural world, specifically in your country, is under threat, it's good to remember someone like Teddy and just all of the fantastic things he did in order to really establish what is a wonderful and worthy national park system in the United States.
And, you know, I think you're right. This was perfect timing. Like Dan said, we're going to try and ratchet down the real world politics. I mean, we're all probably a bunch of politicky people here because we love a game like Civ 6, but, you know, it has its time and its place. But I think this one was, it was especially poignant to bring this one up this week. So I'm glad you did, Dan. Also, for note, I'm trying to stay on top of the news for the state that I'm moving to, great old Utah, and they're having this kind of thing going on there too, where they're trying to potentially get rid of some federal park land that could be used for other things. And there's actually huge backlash from the people there, from if I'm understanding this situation properly. I might not. If there's some Utahns out there, send in an email and let me know if I'm wrong. But it seems like a lot of the people have great value in the parks. And actually, I think that there was someone, one of their representatives for the state, actually is working to strike that down now, the idea of selling off this land or, getting rid of it in some way, because people want the great outdoors. It's something, it's a luxury that we have to protect. If we get rid of it, people will definitely be greedy and abuse that land. So it's something worth protecting.
Yeah, and I think that, we're gamers, and so, people assume that we're inherently indoorsy people, but we appreciate the great outdoors. We love going out and camping and enjoying our national parks. And, here in Canada, too, we have such a wonderful and fantastic, federal park system. So I think that, we need to make sure that we're loving and embracing the great outdoors in equal parts with making sure that, things in our cities and states and provinces and countries are moving more slowly, or pardon me, smoothly. I don't think that we have to sacrifice one for the expediency of the other.
I am totally in agreement with you there, Dan. So I think for this week, we are going to leave you with that. Just as a reminder, you can head over to the website for everything you might need. That's kyledempsterstudios.com/civcast. Just wanted to let our Android listeners know that I added a link to the page that should make it a bit easier for you to subscribe to the show and listen to the episodes. Now, one thing I did do, as a reminder, we changed hosting providers. So if you were someone that streamed the show directly from my webpage in the past, which I just have to doubt that people did that really, because it's not the most effective way. If you pause it and reload the page or something, it would start you over at the beginning. So I'm doubting people did it. But if you were someone that liked having that streaming button right on the page, let me know. There are other alternatives to easily replace it. I'm just not sure that there's real value in doing it unless I get an outcry of people saying, I need the streaming button back. It exists. It's just not there right now. So let me know if you have a different opinion. Also, everything you need to know about the CivCast challenge is on the site, so head over there for that. There is a little nice link to get there. If typing kyledempsterstudios.com/CivCast gets old for you, you can just remember bit.ly/CivCast. Bit.ly links are nice little things to have. So that's just bit.ly/CivCast. It'll take you to the page there. As a reminder, we are on Twitter. I'm at KyleDempster7. Dan is at DanTheMax. And CivCast is there at Civ_cast. As a reminder, we've got our nice little email, civcastpodcast@gmail.com. Should be nice and easy to remember. Go ahead and send us in your thoughts about an economic victory type. And also, if you want to continue that conversation about what sort of wonder you'd like to see added to the game, and to clarify, totally fine if you do want to send in a world wonder. I have no issue with that. I was thinking more of a wonder that you would build, but my fault for not clarifying. I think any answer is a good answer, though. So send us those two answers to our questions. We'll read them on the show, as you saw. You're welcome to send in any and all feedback. We love to read it. Actually, we super, super encourage you to do it. It gives us something fun and dynamic to talk about on the show, and especially if you have some like ideology thoughts or questions about how we do things or how the game should work. I mean, that's just fun stuff to dive into. So make sure you send that stuff in. Also, share the show with your friends. If you've got some Civ players, if you're in a Civ community, whether it's on Reddit or Facebook group or whatever you're in, feel free to send them a link to the show. We'd love to get more of your friends listening and things like that. We're also always doing five-star shout-outs for... I'm sorry, we're doing shout-outs for people that leave stuff five-star reviews on iTunes. So go over there. If you want a shout-out, leave us a nice little review. Those are always nice to see when people are loving it. And also, I like to highlight those on the website. We've got a little slider there that shows reviews of the show. So always love seeing those. I think that about wraps it up for this week for me, Dan. Do you have any parting words for our lovely listeners out there?
No, nothing really clever that comes off the top of my head. Thanks for putting up with my passionate ramblings about the diplomacy system in the game, folks. And give Firaxis your feedback.
I agree. I think this has been probably one of my absolute favorite episodes so far. So, Dan, thank you for joining me on the show. To all our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. It is all about you. I did actually want to promote our Patreon on the way out. We had some great supporters there. So that's patreon.com/civcast. Thanks to everyone that makes this show happen. And until next week, just one more turn. You're listening to the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. For more shows like this, visit kyledempsterstudios.com.